have some sense of how it might feel to be broken, she said. You were his right arm, and without his guidance and protection, I wonder what you now make of yourself. I mean no unkind word. They say you safeguarded him against impulse and iniquity. I am told you counseled him in trying times, and I am told that you are an intelligent boy. And fools despise wisdom and instruction. And he was your instruction, was he not? And now, the good Howell Walker tells me that you can be seen wandering these grounds all hands in no direction. Are you taken as I am, marking your time in any activity hopeful of moving your thoughts from him? Woman is not so different, you know. All have their task. And so I wonder if you, like me, see him in all your works. He is all around me, Hiram. I see his face in the clouds and the land, in my dreams. I see him lost in the mountains. And I see him hemmed in by the river in those last terrible moments, in noble struggle with the depths. This is how he was he not, Hiram? It was you who last saw him, who alone can give account. I do not question his passing, for I lean on my Lord and never my own daily understanding. But I am miserable in my ignorance and imaginings. Tell me that he died as befitting his name, honoring his station. Tell me he died in the true word in which he lived. He saved me, Miss Corrine. That is the fact of it. I don't know why I said this. I had spent very little time in the person of Corrine Quinn, and everything about her rattled me. I was speaking out of instinct, and what it told me was to soothe her, to ease her pain as best I could for my own sake. She brought her gloved hands up and under the veil. Her silence forced me to speak again. I was going under, ma'am, and I reached out, I said. I felt the water around me like great knives, and I surely believed I was done. But he pulled me up until I was strong enough to swim on my own. When I last saw him, he was right with me, but the cold and the tide was too much. She was silent for some moments. When she next spoke, her quavering voice was an iron rod. "You told none of this to Master Howell?" she asked. "No, ma'am," I said. "I have spared him the details, for the very name of his departed son is hard upon his ears. The story grieves us all. I say it only now because you have so heartily requested, and I hope that it shall bring you some portion of peace." "Thank you for this," she said. "You do yourself more credit than you can know." Again, she said nothing for a moment. I stood there awaiting her next request. When she spoke, her voice shifted upward. "So, your master has left you. You are young still, but idling as I hear it. What shall you now make of yourself?"
"I go where I am called, ma'am."
She nodded. "Then perhaps you will be called to my side. Maynard loved you so. Your name was the subject of anticipation. My champion was your champion. He gave his life for you. Perhaps in due course you too shall give of yourself. Do you see this, Hiram?"
"I do," I said. And I did see, if not in that moment, then in the hour of reflection after. The grief and weeping might be true, but more certain was her dark intent, to pry me from Lochless and claim my services, my body, as her own. You have to remember what I was, not human, but property, and a valuable property, one learned in all the functions of the manor, of crops, red, capable of entertaining with my tricks of memory. I was known for my industry, for my steady disposition, for my rectitude. And it would not be hard. I had, through her union with Maynard, been promised to her anyway. And now she would simply appeal to my father to leave this portion in place, to have me given over as terms of bereavement and mourning. and where would I find my home then? It was known that Corrine had property in Elm County, but also farther west, across the mountains in the less developed portion of the state. This was the seed of her fortune, for through the management of multiple interests, timber, salt mines, hemp, it was said she had avoided the fall that now overtook Elm County. Whatever it was, I knew after that meeting I faced a new danger, not Natchez, but a parting from Lochless, the only home I'd ever known. Maynard's body was never found, but it was decided that all the far-flung walkers who were able would assemble at Lochless that Christmas to share their memories of the departed heir. The whole month before, we prepared. We cleaned out, swept, and mopped the upstairs salon, which had fallen into disuse in the years after Maynard's mother died. I dusted mirrors stored in the shed, repaired two old rope beds, and had them, along with the small piano, moved into the house. At night, I worked down in the street with Lorenzo, Bird, Lem, and Frank. It was good to be back there, for they had been my playmates as a young boy. We worked restoring cabins that had gone empty as the number of tasked declined. We fortified roofs, swept out birds' nests, and brought down covers for pallets, for we knew that we would have to house not just walkers, but all the tasked who came with them. I let my mind go numb with the labor, which now assumed a kind of intimate rhythm, so strongly felt that it compelled Lem to call out.
Going way to the great house farm, going up to where the house is warm. When you look for me, Eugenia, I'll be far gone.
And then he called it back again, this time leaving space for his chorus, which was all of us, to repeat each line. And then we took turns adding on from other renditions or from lines all our own, building the ballad out room by room like the great house of which we sang. When it came to me, I hollered out,
"Going away to the great house farm, going up, but it won't be long. Be back, Gina, with my heart and my song."
And then it was decided by the elders that we too must have a feast and a table fit for one. A tree was brought down, stripped and finished, and then installed with legs, and in that fashion we had a feasting table. It was hard work, but forced all the difficult and thorny questions from my mind. On Christmas Eve morning, I stood on the house veranda looking out, and just as the sun peeked over the mountains, which had turned bare and brown, I saw arriving with sunrise the long, snaking train of walkers coming up the road. I counted 10 wagons. I walked downstairs exchanging greetings and then began, with the tasking folk who'd come up, to help unload the baggage. I remember this time as happy, because there was, in this train of walkers, colored people who'd known me as a child, who'd known my mother and spoke of her with a great fondness. As was the holiday tradition then, we were all given an extra share of victuals, 2 pecks of flour and of meal, 2x the share of lard and salted pork, and 2 slaughtered beefs for the whole of us to do with as we wished. From our gardens, we brought up cabbages and collards, and all chickens fit for eating were slaughtered and plucked. On Christmas Day, we divided ourselves, half preparing their feast up at the house, and the rest working together for our feast that night down in the street. I worked most of the morning chopping and hauling wood, both for the cooking and for the bonfire. Then in the afternoon, I walked up through the woods and brought back 10 demijohns of rum and ale. By early evening the sun had set, and the savory smells of our late supper, fried chicken, biscuits, ash cake, and pot liquor, hung over the street. Men and women from Starfall, with relations still at Lochless, brought up pies and treats for dessert. Georgie and his wife, Amber, smiled as they unveiled 2 freshly baked apple cakes. I helped the men haul out the long benches that we had hewn only days earlier, but we had more people than seats, so we retrieved boxes, hogsheads, logs, stones, and whatever else we could find and positioned them around the bonfire. After the kitchen staff had made its way down, prayers were said, and we ate. Then, by the light of the bonfire, With everyone stuffed and bursting at the seams, the stories began of the ghosts of Loch Ness, of all our lost and gone. Zev, my father's first cousin who'd gone to Tennessee, returned with his man, Conway, a child mate of mine, and Conway's sister, Cat. They'd seen my Uncle Josiah, who now had a new wife and two little girls. They'd seen Clay and Sheila, who, through some incredible magic, had been sold off the land but sold together, and so had that as comfort. And there was Philippa, Thomas, and Brick, who'd been carried off with Zev, and were now old but still alive. Then the talk turned to Maynard.
"That boy was mourned in death more than he was loved in life," said Conway.
He was sitting by the fire with his hands extended to warm them.
"The lies come like gospel to these folk. Why, I tell you, they used to talk about that boy like he was the fall of nature. Now they telling us he was Christ risen."
"It's homecoming," said Cat.
"Suppose they should detail each of his sinnings."
"Would be a start," said Sophia. "When I go, I don't want no lies spoken over my body. Tell them, start to end, what I was."
"Way it go for us folks," said Cat. "Don't nobody say nothing except get to digging."
"Whatever it takes," said Sophia. "Just no lying, no gossamer. I came here rough, lived as such, and will die the same. Ain't much more needin' to be said."
"Ain't about Maynard," said Conway. "It's about them who was putting him to rest, about excusing themselves after a man they kicked around got himself drowned in the Goose. I tell you, it got even me. I used to riddle that boy something silly. I never got to see him as a man. Way I'm hearing it, Maynard ain't much change. And if that is so, I bet they full of guilt and need to share. Y'all niggas just as dumb as they say," said Thina.
She was standing near the bonfire looking directly into the flame.
"Y'all think this is about Maynard?"
No one replied, and now Thina looked up and scanned her audience. The truth is, everyone was afraid of her. But the silence that now emerged from this fear only agitated her more.
"Land, niggas! Land! This here land right here! They flattering that man Howell," she said.
She paused again and looked around. I was close enough to see the shadow of the bonfire dancing off her face and the wintry clouds of her breath.
"It's his bequest they after. Land, niggas, land, and us. This whole thing is a game, and the winner get to take hold of this place, get to take hold of us."
We already understood. But this was our farewell, too, perhaps the last time we would gather in community. And none wished to ruin the moment by loudly trumpeting this fact. But Thina, owing to her particular injuries and disposition, could not smile, could not lose herself in jest and reminiscence. So she shook her head and sucked her teeth, then pulled her long white shawl around her and stomped away. Everyone sat there. Eyes now downcast, stunned back into the reality Thina had put upon them. I waited a few minutes and then walked down to the far end of the street until I reached the farthest cabin, the one set off from the others, the one where Thina once stood with her broom running off children, where I had appeared all those years ago, sensing that this woman in particular would understand the betrayal I felt. And now I saw her standing before her old cabin, lost in her own particular thoughts. I walked over and stood close enough so that she knew that I was there. She looked over at me for a few seconds, and I saw that her face had now softened. Then she turned back to the cabin. I stood with her for a moment and then walked back up, leaving her to her thoughts. When I returned, the conversation had turned back to stories, now reaching into a deep past, as much myth as memory.
"Ain't no such thing," said Georgie. "I say it is," said Cat. "And I say it ain't," said Georgie. "If any colors had ever walked down to the Goose and vanished, I tell you, I'd know it."
Now Cat spotted me and said,
"You know it, hi. It was your grandmother, was your Santy Bess."
I shook my head and said, "Never met her. you know, about as much as I do. Georgie shook his head and waved his hands at Cat and said,
Leave that boy out of it. He don't know nothing. I'm telling you, if some slave woman walked off this here lockless and took 50-odd of us with her, I would know. I'm tired of hearing of this. Every year it's the same.
Was before your time, said Cat. My Auntie Elma was about these parts back then. Say she lost her first husband when he walked down with Santy Bess into the Goose. Said he went back home.
Every year,
Georgie said, shaking his head.
Every damn year it's the same with y'all. But I'm telling you, I'm the one who'd know, not none of y'all.
I felt everything go quiet just then. It was true. At every gathering there was this dispute about my mother's mother, Santy Bess, and her fate. The myth held that she had executed the largest escape of Tasking folk, 48 souls, ever recorded in the annals of Elm County. But it was not simply that they had escaped, but where they'd been said to escape to, Africa. It was said that Santy had simply led them down to the River Goose, walked in, and re-emerged on the other side of the sea. It was preposterous. That was what I had always thought, what I had to think, because Santy's story came to me in a mix of rumor and whisper. And this faulty narration was fractured even more by the fact that so many of her generation and the one following had been sold off, so that by my time, not a single person left in Elm County had seen Santy Bess for themselves. My thoughts were with Georgie. I doubted she even existed. But it was not Georgie's assault on Santy Bess that made everyone quiet. It was his certitude. I know, he had said. Cat walked over until she stood directly in front of Georgie. She smiled and said, And how's that, Georgie? How would you know? I looked hard at Georgie Parks. The sun had set long ago, but the light of the bonfire showed his whole face frozen in discomfort. Now Amber sidled up beside him.
Yeah, Georgie, she said. How you know?
Georgie glanced around. All eyes were fixed on him.
Don't none of y'all worry, he said. I know.
There was a rumble of nervous laughter, and then the conversation switched back to Maynard, and more news from all the far-flung places that our people now called home. It was late now, but the spirit was such that none wanted to part. And I am not sure how it happened or when, because I was not watching for it, my mind was still on Thena, but by the time I caught wind, it was all already in motion. I heard the beat but paid it no mind, until a few began to gather on the farther end of the bonfire, and looking over there I saw that one of the tobacco men, Amici, had pulled a chair out of the quarters, and a washpan and sticks, and with this he was tapping out a beat, something up and happy. And then two, then three, Tasking folk began clapping and slapping their knees, and then I saw Pete, the gardener, walk over with a banjo, and then strum the strings, and then it felt like it all happened at once. Spoons, sticks, jaw harps, the dance was upon us, had bloomed seemingly of its own accord, and there was now a circle just off from the fire. And there was a girl with her hand on the end of her skirt swaying her hips to the beat. And what I now saw was an earthen jar on the girl's head, and looking down to her face, I saw that the girl was Sophia. I looked up into the starry, cloudless night, and judging by the half-moon's journey across the sky, I knew that it was somewhere close to midnight. The fire roared high, beating back the December chill, and before I knew it, everyone was in the street dancing. I slowly backed away until I had a view of everything. There were dozens of us down there. It was an entire nation in movement. Some of us paired off, others in small semicircles, others alone. I looked over toward the quarters and saw Thena, seated on the steps of one of the cabins, nodding to the beat. I watched Sophia, a flurry of limbs but all under control and the jar seemingly fused to her head, never moving, and when one of the men got too close, I watched her pull him in and whisper something, which must have been rude, for the man stopped there and simply walked away. And then she looked and saw me watching her, and at that she smiled and walked toward me. and as she did, she angled her head so that the jar slid, and reaching up with her right hand, she caught the jar by the neck. Now standing in front of me, she sipped from the jar and then passed it to me. I drew it to my lips and recoiled at its taste, for I had assumed it to be water. She laughed and said, "Too much for you, huh?" Still holding the ale, I looked at her and drew it to my lips again, keeping eye contact, and drank and drank and drank, and then handed the empty jar back to her. I did not know what made me do such a thing, at least not then I did not, but I knew well what it meant, even if I tried to deny it myself. She knew too. And cutting her eyes, she put the jar down, jogged over to the far end of the table, disappearing among the shadows, then came back with a full demijohn and handed it to me. "Let's walk," she said. "All right," I said. "Where are we going?" "You tell me," she said. And so we did walk, and let the sound of the music die behind us as we moved up from the street until we were back near the lawn and the main house of Lochless. There was a small gazebo off to the side, below which was the ice house. We sat with a demijohn of ale, passing it back and forth silently, until our heads were swimming in it. "So, yeah," she said, breaking the silence. "Thina." "Yeah," I said. "Wasn't no lie, though, was it?" "Nope." "You know what happened to her?"
"You mean to make her this way?"
"I do, but I feel like it's her story to tell."
"But she told you, huh?" she said. "She always been soft with you."
"Thina ain't soft with nobody, Sophia, even before whatever happened, happened. I suspect she was never soft on any of her folk."
"Huh," she said. "And what about you?"
"Hmm? You hard on your folks, too."
"Most generally am," I said, "but of course, depend on the folk." Then I took another drink from the demijohn and passed it to her. And she was looking at me now, not smiling, just studying me. It was clear to me that I had gone into the goose one way and come out the other. I wondered how I had endured all those rides to Nathaniel's, seated next to her. Wondered if I had somehow been blinded. She was such a lovely girl. I wanted to be with her in a way that I would never want anyone again. In a way that age and experience rob you of, which is to say, I wanted all of her, from her coffee skin to her brown eyes, from her soft mouth to her long arms, from her low voice to her wicked laugh. I wanted it all. And I was not thinking of all the terror that had come with that, the terror that had swallowed her life. All I was thinking about was the light dancing in me, dancing to some music I hoped only she would hear.
"Huh," she said, then looked away.
She took another drink and set the ale at her feet, and looked up at the starry sky, and when her eyes moved away, I felt jealous of the heavens themselves. And with that feeling, a range of thoughts came to me. I thought of Corrine and Hawkins, and how these well could be my last days at Lochless, gone not to Natchez, but gone all the same. I thought of Georgie and all that he might know. I felt Sophia's hand slipping its way through my arm until our arms were locked. She sighed, her head on my shoulder, and we sat there watching the stars over Virginia. Chapter 7 Holiday passed, and we said our final goodbyes, more final than any on this earth, and then the new year, and with it, our diminished numbers. Corrine was still in the habit of her daily visits and murmured intimations of my fate, and I knew then, given the sway she held with my father, that it would not be long before these intimations became real. My days at Lochless were numbered. My father had taken note of the restored highboy, and so it came down from Roscoe that my task would now be the resurrection of furniture pieces from ages past. I read documents from my father's study that detailed the precise date each piece was fashioned or purchased, some stretching all the way back to the progenitor, so that these pieces came to represent a story of my ancestry. An ancestry that would end with me, a a slave, sold away from this land, unable to save it or the people who'd built it, and burnished it, and made it thrive, who would be broken apart and scattered to the wind, but still in chains. The old thoughts of Oregon thickened as I read. I could not save Lochless, but another scheme was growing hotter in me. Should I be divided from Lochless, perhaps I might be divided on my own terms. And that led me back to thoughts of Georgie Parks, and precisely what he might know. It was just a notion in my mind when I walked out that early Friday to complete my ritual drive of Sophia to Nathaniel's place. I walked over to the stables and hitched two horses to the pleasure wagon. It was still dark, but I had done this so often before and was so used to working before dawn that I was able to perform the necessary exercise blind. I had just finished the hitching when I looked up and saw her. "Morning," Sophia said. "Morning," I said. She was fully dressed in her outfit, bonnet, crinoline skirt, long coat. I wondered at what hour she had risen to make it all work, and watching her delicately move, with the aid of my hand, into the chaise, it occurred to me that Sophia's ability to take on the trappings of a lady wasn't an accident. It had been her life's work to dress Helen Walker, Nathaniel's late wife, to move through the difficult ritual of creams and nail polishings of corsets and bodices. She knew this ritual better than Helen knew it herself. Halfway through our ride, I looked over and saw Sophia looking out at the frozen trees, lost in her own thoughts, as was her tendency. "What you think?" she asked. I had been in her company long enough to be familiar with this habit of beginning conversations in her head and then continuing them out loud. "I think so," I said. Now she faced me and a look of incredulity came over her face. "You got no idea what I'm talking about, do you?" she said. "I do not," I said. She laughed to herself and said, "So you was just going to let me talk as though you knew?" "Why not?" I said. "Figure I'd catch on soon enough." "And what if it was something you ain't want to hear?" "Well, seeing as how I won't know till I hear it, guess that's a risk I'm taking. Besides, you already in it. Can't back out now." "Mm-hmm," she said, nodding. "I guess so, but it's personal, huh, you see? Goes back to the times before I come to Lochless."
"Back to them Carolinas," I said.
"Yep. Good old Carolina." Sophia said this softly, blowing out each word. "You was a maid to Nathaniel's wife back then, right?" I asked. "Wasn't just any old maid," she said. "Me and Helen, we were friends. At least, we was friends once. I loved her, you know. I think I can say that. I loved her. And when I think of Helen, I think only of the best times." She was wistful as she said this, and I felt I understood how it happened for girls like her, how it began for them as children, when they played together with their one-day mistresses caring nothing for color, and were told to love them as they would love any other playmate. They grow together, and as the play hours decline, the ritual changes. They are both weaned on the religion of society, of slavery, which holds that for no particularly good reason, one of them will live in the palace, while the other will be condemned to the dungeon. It's a cruel thing to do to children, to raise them as though they are siblings, and then set them against each other so that one shall be a queen, and the other shall be a footstool.
"Our games used to carry us off," Sophia said. "We used to make ourselves up as the grand ladies would in their big dresses. We would play together in the fields back in Carolina. Once I fell, and I rolled right into some briars. I must have yelled to the devil and back, but she was right there for me. She gathered me up and got me back to the home place. I am powerfully remembered to her, high, and when I see the briars now, I don't think of the pain, for I am thinking only of her."
She said this looking straight at the road.
"I'm telling you that we were us before we were him," she said. "We were something to each other, and that is now smoke.
The man she loved wanted me. It was not for any love of me, Hiram. I was jewelry to him. I knew it. And then my Helen died bearing his child, and I cannot tell you the pain and guiltiness that came over me.
She stopped there, and we rode along, and all that was heard was horse and wheels crunching against the frozen road. I had the feeling that this was coming to some terrible revelation.
"Do you know, I still see her in my dreams," she said.
"I ain't surprised," I said. "I still see Maynard, though I confess my recollections don't have half the magic of your own."
"Ain't no magic, though," she said. "Sometimes high, sometimes. It is my feeling that she got away and left me with—"
Now she turned to me, breaking her gaze into the woods.
"He'll never let me loose till I'm used up, you see? Then he'll send me out of Elm somewhere and take up another colored girl for his fancy. We really ain't nothing but jewelry to them. I always known this, I think, but I am getting older, high, and knowing something is a far measure from truly seeing it."
"Takes some time," I said. She was quiet again, and for a few moments there was nothing but the gentle clopping of the horse along the road.
"You ever wonder about the rest of your life?" she said. "You ever wonder about young'uns? About any life that might be out there waiting for you?"
"Lately," I said, I wonder about everything."
"I think of young'uns all the time," she said. "I think of what it must mean to bring someone, a little girl perhaps, into all of this. And I know it's coming some day, that it ain't even up to me. It's coming, Hiram, and I will watch as my daughter is taken in, as I was taken in, and I am trying to tell you that this all has me wondering about something else, about another life, past the goose, maybe past them mountains, past—"
And her voice trailed off, and she was looking off to the side of the road again. And I think now that this is how the running so often begins. That it is settled upon in that moment you understand the great depth of your peril. For it is not simply by slavery that you are captured, but by a kind of fraud which paints its executors as guardians at the gate, staving off African savagery, when it is they themselves who are the savages, who are Mordred, who are the dragon in Camelot's clothes. And at that moment of revelation, of understanding, running is not a thought, not even a dream, but a need, no different than the need to flee a burning house.
"Hiram," she said, "I don't know why I come to you with this. All I know is you have always been one who saw more, who knew more. And then you met the goose. We thought you was dead. You were there at the gates, and I watched you turn away, and I wondered how a man could come back looking upon the world the same."
"I know what you are speaking of," I said.
"I am speaking of facts," she said.
"You are speaking of goodbye," I said. "And to where? How could we live in any way out there?" She placed a hand on my arm.
"How can you come up out of the goose alive and in any way still live here? I am speaking of facts."
"You can't even name it," I said.
"But I can name this and every kind of life that will come after," she said. "We could go together, huh? You are red and know of things far past Lochless and the goose. You must have some need of it. You must have found yourself dreaming of it, waking up now and again, gripped in it. You must have some wanting to know all that you, all that we, might become out from under here."
I did not answer. We could now see the great opening in the road that marked Nathaniel Walker's place. I drove past this opening and turned down a side path, which was our customary approach. I stopped the horse at the end of the path. Through the trees I could see Nathaniel Walker's brick main house. I watched as a well-dressed tasking man came down the way. He nodded when he saw us, then motioned wordlessly for Sophia. She stepped out of the chaise and looked back at me. I noted right then that she had never done this before. Instead, she usually walked right on with her escort. But now she paused and looked back, and what she said in that silence was something resolute, certain. And I knew then, looking at her, that we must run. As I pulled away from Nathaniel Walker's place, my mind now focused again on Georgie Parks. I must find him. I had known Georgie all my life, and I understood that he might fear for me as a father fears for the son about to go off to war. I understood. Georgie had seen so many hauled down to the block and sent Natchez way. I even sympathized. But still, I had to run. Everything seemed to point me to it. The library volume, scheming Corrine and bizarre Hawkins, the fate of Lochless itself, always chancy but now airless, dire. And Sophia, who seemed to share in my desperation, in my need to see whatever lay beyond those three hills, past Starfall, past the Goose and its many bridges, past Virginia itself. You must have some need of it. I did. But the only route I then knew must be walked by the light of Georgie Parks. The following Saturday afternoon, I worked on the drawers of a cherry secretary and satisfied that they were again running easy. I washed, put on a change of clothes, and made my way to the home of Georgie Parks. I was not far into Starfall when I spotted Hawkins and Amy just outside the inn, both still in mourning black. They were distracted by their own conversation and did not see me, and so I kept my distance and watched Hawkins and Amy for a moment before continuing on my way. I wanted no conversation, for their habit of picking at all the details of my life and my intentions had become intolerable to me. All of their questions gave way to other questions. I found Georgie standing in front of his home, a short walk from Ryland's jail. I smiled. Georgie did not. He motioned for me to walk with him. We kept to the road for a bit, then turned off onto a smaller path where the town began to give way to the wilderness, and then took a dirt path which brought us through some tangled green that opened to a small pond. Georgie said nothing during our short walk, and now gazed at the pond for a moment before speaking. "I like you, Hiram," Georgie said. "I really do. If I were so lucky as to have a daughter about your season, you would be my only choice. You are smart, you keep your mouth where it should be, and you were more better to Maynard than such a man ever deserved." He rubbed his red-brown beard, turned, and looked up into the trees. His back was now to me. I heard him say, "Which is why I can't for the fact of things understand how a man such as you would come to my door looking for trouble." When he turned back to me, his deep brown eyes were simmering. "What would a respectable man like you want with this?" he asked. "And by what reasoning have you got it figured that I am the one who shall award it?" "Georgie, I know," I said. "We all know. Perhaps you have hid it away from the quality, but we have always been smarter than them." "You don't see the half of it, son. And I am telling, as I have told you before, go home. Get a wife and get happy. Ain't nothing over here."
"Georgie, I am going," I told him. "And I ain't going alone."
"What?"
"Sophia going with me."
"Nathaniel Walker's girl? Have you lost it? You take that girl and you might as well spit on that man. It is a high offense against any white man's honor."
"We are going. And Georgie," I said with only a hint of the anger I now felt in me,
"she ain't his."
It was not only anger in me. I was 19, and a guarded 19 who'd worked to feel nothing in this direction, so that when I did feel it, right there, in that moment, when I did feel that I loved her, it was not with reason or ritual, nor the way that makes families and homes, but the way that wrecks them. I was undone.
"Now, let's get one thing straight here," Georgie said. "She is his girl. They're all his girl, you get it? Amber, his girl. Thena, his girl. Your mother was his girl."
"Careful, Georgie," I said. "Real
careful.
Oh, it's careful now, huh? Is that what it is? You telling me about careful, son? They own you, Hiram. You a slave boy. I don't care who your daddy is. You a slave, and don't think that just because I'm out this way, out here in this free town, that I ain't some kind of slave, too. As long as they own you, they own her. You got to see, we are captured, been captured, and that's the whole of it. What you are talking here done got men a whole week in Rylands and beat within a prayer of their life. Now, you have got a feeling in your heart, and I respect it. I done felt it myself. What young man ain't? But you almost died, huh? You do this, and you will wish you had.
Georgie, I am telling you that this is not a choice.
I cannot stay. And you have got to help. Even if I was what you have me figured to be, I would not.
You ain't understanding, I said. I am going. That is a fact. I am asking you to aid me because I believe you an honorable man devoted to the honorable path.
I am asking you, Georgie, but I am going.
Georgie paced for a moment, executing his own internal calculations, for he knew now that with his help or without, I was going and I was going with Sophia. What I could not know as he regarded me there, his eyes widening with realization, was that he must have been figuring on the consequence of such an action, and his conclusion made clear, and whatever his hatreds, whatever his loves, especially his loves, he now saw but one path forward.
1 week, he said. You got 1 week. You meet me here on this spot where we now stand with your girl. You should know that I would not do any such thing if not for what you have told me here and determined yourself to do.
My power was always memory, not judgment. I walked away from George's home fixed only on my own suspicions, never suspecting how much beyond those the fact of things truly ranged. And even when I, again, came upon Amy and Hawkins, this time seen straight by them right outside the general store, I could not see how the pieces fit. There had been no way to avoid them this time, for I had been so lost in thoughts of Georgie, of Sophia, that they had seen me before I saw them.
"How you carrying it, small stepper?"
Hawkins said. "Well and fine enough," I said. It was now early evening, and dusk had begun to fall over the town. The locals of Elm County who'd come into town for business now drifted out on their pleasure wagons and chaises. I regarded Hawkins warily, trying to find the quickest road out of conversation.
"What you got bringing you into town?"
he asked, and to this he married his characteristic thin-lipped smile. I didn't answer, and I saw by the shift in his face that he now knew that he'd assumed a familiarity that was not there. But this did nothing to stop him.
"Oh, I'm sorry," he said. "Don't mean to cause no injury or offense. Ladies say we should be as family, though, right?"
"Calling on a friend," I said.
"Friend like Georgie Parks?"
There were all kinds of ways to task in Virginia, ways beyond the fields, the kitchens, or the shed. Some tasking was not so material. Offering entertainment, sharing wisdom. And then there were even darker tasks. To be their eyes and ears, their intelligence among the other tasking men, so that they, the masters, knew who smiled on their faces and scoffed behind their backs, who stole from them, who burned down the barn, who poisoned, and who plotted. The effect of all this was a kind of watchfulness among the tasking folks, in particular towards those you did not know. This worked the other way, too, so that if you were new to Lockless or any of these other houses of bondage, you took things slow, you did not question or inquire on people's affairs, for if you did, you might then be thought to be among those who were eyes and ears, who tasked beyond the task. And this was a dangerous place because then you yourself might be poisoned or plotted against. But Hawkins took no care, which gave his question a sinister import.
"Ain't nothing," he went on. "My sister Amy got people tasking this way. Say she see you over at Georgie's from time to time.
Amy stood eyeing us both. And I saw now that she seemed nervous about something that was soon to happen, or an event she would like to not miss. "Yeah," I said, still uneasy. "Georgie is known to me."
"Uh-huh," he said. "Georgie's quite a fella."
I looked back to Amy, who was no longer shifting her eyes nervously, but casting them a block away. Following her gaze, I saw my old tutor, Mr. Fields, coming toward her. This was now twice in 3 months, twice after having not seen him in 7 years. What was more, Mr. Fields was clearly walking toward Amy as though he had some appointed rendezvous with her and Hawkins. He saw me before he reached her and froze for a moment. I had the sense that some plan of his had gone awry, and he would very much like to change direction. But instead, he once again doffed his hat, as he had those months ago at race day. Hawkins followed my eyes to Mr. Fields, who by now was standing at Amy's side. They were watching us and in some state of confusion. And Hawkins was no longer smiling. Indeed, he looked quite nervous himself, watching them watch us. But then he turned back to me, and the smile was recalled.
"Well," he said, "I guess that's my folks calling on me."
"Guessing it is," I said. And then it was my turn to smile, and I am not sure why, except to say that it was my feeling that Hawkins had been lying to me, lying about where he'd found me, lying about the motive of his questions. And I felt I had at last caught him unawares and managed to drag some portion of his secret machinations into the light. And his discomfort at this made me smile. I stood there and watched him walk over to Amy and Mr. Fields and then tipped my hat once again to the whole party as they walked off. I should have thought more on those events. I should have wondered at the familiarity between two tasking folks and a learned man of the North. I should have seen the connections with Georgie Parks. But my mind was swimming in the ocean of possibilities opened up by Georgie's ascent. And more, my great concern was not with uncovering the plotting of others, but with how I might best conceal my own. The next day I rode back to Nathaniel's estate to retrieve Sophia. 15 minutes into my ride, not far from home, I was stopped by the patrol of Low Whites, Ryland's hounds, who haunted the woods in search of runaways. I produced my papers for them, and seeing Howell's name upon them, they quickly allowed me on my way. But the event shook me, for I had by then completed a shift inside of myself. I had already gone from task to fugitive. I so greatly feared that they would see it in me. In some misbegotten smile or unlikely ease. But Ryland's hounds were white, low whites, but white all the same, so that their power blinded them. Sophia and I rode back in silence, saying nothing. But just before reaching Lochless, I stopped the chaise. It was late morning and cold. No one was on the road, and the only sound was the wind whipping through the bare branches, that and my pounding heart. I wondered if Sophia had been taken in on some design. Phantoms flittered before me like moths, and for a moment I saw them all in concert together. Howell, Nathaniel, Corrine, Sophia, even Maynard, who did not die, who presided over my dreams where he rose up out of the icy teeth of the goose detailing the roster of my sins. But when I looked over and saw her, brown eyes looking out into the forest as she often did, not even noting our pause, when I saw her there, seeming so cool and far above the cares of the world, the feelings in me welled up and overwhelmed. And then she spoke. "I got to get out, High," she said. "I will not be an old woman down in the coffin. I will bring no child to this. Ain't no society here, no rules, no prohibitions. They took it all with them to Kentucky, Mississippi, Tennessee. Ain't nothing left. It's all gone, Natchez way." She paused for a moment and then said again, slower this time, "I got to get out." "Right," I said. "Then let's get out." Chapter 8. I am so much older now, old enough to understand how a tangle of events can be unraveled to reveal a singular thread. So, as to my freedom, the events stood thus. I knew that I would never advance beyond my blood-bound place at Lochless. And I knew that even if I did, Lochless, whatever its past glories, was falling, as all the great houses of slavery were falling. And when they fell, I would not be freed, but would instead be sold or passed off. And I knew by then that my genius would not save me. Indeed, my genius would only make me a more valuable commodity. I was convinced that this was what had attracted Corrine, that she, aided by the mendacity of her people, was making an early, if still mysterious, claim. And my own view of this claim, of everything really, was altered from the moment I walked out of the Goose. And all of that, my knowledge, my destiny, my escape from death, taken together was like a bomb in my chest. And Sophia, and her intentions, were the fuse. This was how I saw her back then, as the necessary end point of my calculations. It all made sense to me, but would have made more had I considered that Sophia was a woman of her own mind, with intentions, calculations, and considerations all her own. She came upon me later that week, while I was outside working a set of corner chairs, and when I saw her, the fuse burning in me, I felt a kind of daring. She stopped and smiled, looked at the corner chair, and then began walking into the shed. "Don't think you want to do that," I said. "Ain't really no place for a lady." "Ain't no lady," she said, walking inside. I followed her in and watched as she wiped away the cobwebs and ran her fingers against the furniture to judge how much she could accumulate in one swipe. She walked among the pieces, passing the maple drunkard's chair, then the Heplewhite table and the Queen Anne clock, the light from the small window cutting against the dark. "Huh," she said, turning to face me. "This all yours to work?" "I guess." "Howell's word?" "Yep, by way of Roscoe. But really, I just got sick of laying up there waiting for them to tell me something. Besides, this is how it was when I was a boy. Used to get in where I could, work where I was needed." "Could still go out to the fields," she said. "They always looking for hands." "Did my share of that, thank you kindly," I said. "How about you? Ever been in them fields?" "Can't say that I have," Sophia said. She was now closer, and I noted this because I noted everything about her now. In particular, the precise distance she maintained from me. There was a part of me that knew this to be all wrong. But it was the discredited part, the part that believed a coin could reverse Virginia against itself. "Not the worst," I said. "Don't have these folks watching every little thing you do." She was closer still. "What kind of things you might like to hide?" she said, moving closer, so that I now felt my balance slipping away. I put my hand down on a piece of furniture, I can't remember which. She just looked at me and laughed, then walked back out of the shed. "Can we talk some more?" she said, almost whispering. "About all that?" "Yeah, we can," I said. "In an hour," she said, "down by the gulch?" "Sounds good to me," I said. I don't know what work happened in the time before the meeting. I spent the whole of it thinking only of Sophia. Slavery is everyday longing, is being born into a world of forbidden victuals and tantalizing untouchables, the land around you, the clothes you hem, the biscuits you bake. You bury the longing, because you know where it must lead. But now this new longing held out a different future, one where my children, whatever their travails, would never know the auction block. And once I glimpsed that other future, my God, the world was born anew to me. I was freedom-bound, and freedom was as much in my heart as it was in the swamps, so that the hour I spent waiting on our meeting was the most careless I had ever spent. I was gone from Lochless before I had even run. "So, how's this supposed to go?" she asked. We were down by the gulch, looking past the wild grass to the other side of the woods. "I don't quite know," I said. Sophia turned to me with a doubtful look.
"Don't know?" she asked.
"I put my faith in Georgie," I said. "That's all I got."
"Georgie, huh?"
"Yeah, Georgie. I ain't ask a whole lot of questions. You must understand why. This thing Georgie got himself into, well, I imagine part of the deal is you don't talk too much. So my notion is simple. We bring ourselves and nothing more at the appointed time and place, and then we go."
"Go into what?" she asked.
I looked at her hard for a moment, then looked back over the gulch. "The swamps," I said. "They got a world down there, a whole underground where a man can live as a man should."
"And what about a woman?"
"I know. I thought on it some. Perhaps not the ideal place for a lady," she cut me off and said.
"Told you once today, hi, I ain't no lady."
I nodded.
"I get along just fine," she said. "Just get me out of here, and I'll get the rest figured myself."
That last word, myself, hung in the air.
"Oh, by yourself, huh?" I asked.
She looked back at me, unsmiling.
"Look, Hiram, I need you to understand something. I like you, I really do."
Her eyes were hard on me, drilling their way in, and I felt that what she was saying now was from the deepest of possible places.
"I like you, and I do not like many men. And when I look at you, I see something old and familiar, something like what I had with my Mercury. But I will like you a heap less if your plan is for us to get to this underground and for you to make yourself up as another Nathaniel. That ain't freedom to me. Do you understand? Ain't no freedom for a woman in trading a white man for a colored."
I noticed then that her hand was on my arm, and that she was squeezing it firmly.
"If that is what you want, if that is what you are thinking, then you must tell me, now. If it is your plan to shackle me there, to have me bring yearlings to you, then tell me now and allow me the decency of making my own choice here. You are not like them. You must do me the service of giving me that choice. So tell me. Tell me now you're intending."
I remember her ferocity in that moment. It was such a peaceful day. Late in the afternoon now, and the sun was setting in the season of long nights, the perfect season, I would soon learn, to run. I heard no birds, no insects, no branches in the wind, so that all my senses were focused on Sophia's words, words that for the first time in my life I experienced without pictures, for reasons I could not fully then understand. What I did understand was that she was terribly afraid of something, something in me. And the thought that I would in any way exist to her in the way of Nathaniel, that she would fear me as she feared him, scared and shamed me all at once. "No," I said. "Never, Sophia. I want you to be free. And I want any relating between us, should there ever be relating, to always be one of your choosing." She loosened her hand now so that her grip became just a touch.
"I cannot lie," I said. "I hope that you will someday, at some time, choose me out there. I confess it. I have dreams, wild dreams."
"And what do you dream of?" she asked. Her grip was again tight on my arm. "I dream of men and women who are fit to wash, feed, and dress themselves. I dream of rose gardens that reward the hands that tend to them," I said. "And I dream of being able to turn to a woman for whom I got a feeling and speak that feeling, holler that feeling, with no thought beyond me and her as to what that might mean." We stood there a little longer and then walked up from the gulch together and then out of the woods. By then, the sun was setting over Loch Ness. We paused at the edge of the woods. Sophia said,
"I had best go ahead alone."
I nodded and watched her walk out and disappear. And then I came out, up from the forest toward the house, until I could see the tunnel beneath into the warrens. And standing there in that tunnel, with her arms crossed, was Thina. Thina was also transformed by my new vantage. I was running off, a young man with a young girl, toward a new life, the first true life we'd ever have, one that these old coloreds were afraid to pursue. I had tried to save them, save the whole of Lochless, but that was over now. There were lambs waiting for the slaughter. The elders all knew what was coming. They knew what the land whispered because none lived closer to the land than those who worked it. They lay awake at night listening to the groaning ghosts of tasking folk past, those who'd been carried off. They knew what was coming, and still they waited for it. And all of this sudden shame and anger, rage and resenting for they who let this happen, who stoically watched their children carried off, all of this I now heaped upon Thena. So then when she saw me there coming up from the woods, and I saw her, with her arms crossed, waiting for me as I approached, and I saw the disapproving look on her face, I felt an incredible anger. "Evening," I said. She rolled her eyes in response. I walked into the tunnel and toward my quarters. She followed me. When we were inside, she turned up the lamp on the mantel and then shut the door. She sat in a chair in the corner, and I saw the flame of the lamp casting shadows on her face.
"What is with you, son?"